From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about your own daily routine. For most of us, it includes at least one glance at a weather forecast. The writer Peter Moore says it's hard to imagine a time before there was a forecast, which he describes as an ingrained component of modern life. But it wasn't that long ago that the weather was a legitimate mystery. Even in a time when science was figuring out other things, there was no language to explain how the weather really worked. Mostly people chalked it up to God's doing. In his new book, Moore focuses on that crucial period of time when science broke free from that mystery and figured out how clouds and winds and storms really worked. Today in the program, Peter Moore is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Weather Experiment. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are varying degrees of this very human impulse to know what the weather's going to be like. You've got your Weather Channel nerds who watch Doppler radar and storm surge videos as a pastime, which is extreme, but pretty much everyone has a weather app, and we all want to know whether it's going to rain on Saturday. In his book called The Weather Experiment, the writer Peter Moore explains how for hundreds, really thousands of years, weather was just a mystery. I mean, you had some theories. People thought weather was affected by the orbit of the moon or the electricity in the sky or that there was something in the soil that created wind and rain and things. But really, it wasn't until about 1800 that most people just figured there was some divine origin to the weather, that this was God's province. In 1800, that started to really change. And this is when Peter Moore's book begins. He explores these 70 critical years in the development of the science of weather. And it's not boring. I mean, you have eclectic people with radical theories and audacious experiments who really lay the foundation for giving this brief glimpse of the future. And you'll be surprised how controversial it was for a scientist to say they could actually predict the weather. It's called The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. And Peter Moore is joining us throughout the hour. You can join us, too, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter Moore is a writer and an historian, a visiting lecturer at the City University in London. He's also author of the book Damn His Blood, which investigates an early 19th century murder. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And Peter Moore, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Doug. It's good to talk to you. I should tell you, we're right in the middle of a storm here in London, so it's the perfect time to talk about the weather, I think.
Well, you know what it made me think of? I was thinking about Thomas Jefferson, and then I was thinking about the shipping forecast, and I was wondering who's more obsessed about the weather, do you figure, the Brits or the Americans?
Well, I think we have different types of weather, so maybe we have different types of obsessives. Maybe you have all the storm chasers, which is a really big thing in the States. And we've never really got that far. I think our obsessives are probably more about, the more gentler side of weather, you know, which way the wind's blowing and such. Like, we do have our obsessives. We have lots of cloud spotters here in the UK. Last week I was talking to a man who'd founded the Cloud Appreciation Society, which is a quite quirky little society which has about 40,000 members globally as well. I'm sure there's some in the States too, where people just enjoy looking at clouds, which are strange shapes, and try to kind of get away from this idea of blue sky thinking. So that's the kind of obsessives we have. But we don't have the storm chasers quite so much.
So what got you thinking? I mean, were you... you're not an obsessive, I'm guessing, about the weather, but what got you thinking about this? I mean, this little moment in time, and because it was such a critical time, but what got you thinking about it?
Yeah, I came from a really strange angle at this story because I'm not a meteorologist. I stopped doing science when I was 16, really, and so you'd think it's a very strange book for me to write, and I think I surprised quite a few of my friends when I said I was going to write about the weather. But yeah. It really came from the previous book, which was this reconstruction, historical reconstruction of a murder which happened in the English countryside in the year 1806. And this murder was, you know, like a great sensation, and I wanted to reconstruct it in as much detail as possible. And one of the things I wanted to find out was what was the weather like on the day of the crime, because I was just trying to kind of add a bit of flavour, a bit of detail to the facts that we had. And so that took me back to these 19th century weather records, and I was really surprised at reading them, because they seemed so, I mean, they were written in, you know, in our English language, but they seemed so foreign. The language was really archaic, and I was, I suppose, what that made me curious about was, what did people understand and what did they know at that time? You know, they talked about things like a fret of wind or a tempest, or, you know, the language was very descriptive, and it was very colourful language, and quite beautiful, actually, in lots of the cases, but it wasn't scientific. Mm. And I suppose that sparked off this interest in what did people know about weather in the year 1806, which I soon found out was very little at all. They didn't understand all these fundamentals. So that's where I started, and then I went into the records from there.
Yeah,
that was the beginning.
Did that surprise you, though, that, it, you know, 1806, surely, I mean, there's a lot going on, and the Enlightenment's kicked into gear. People are, scientists are exploring all kinds of other things, but this is one of those things that at that time, certainly, as I sort of mentioned in the introduction, people just figured it was God who was going to figure out the weather.
They did, yeah. I think, I mean, if you ever read any of the romantic poetry, which was the kind of poetry of the age, the Shelleys, the Byrons, these kind of people, they write a lot about skies and clouds and atmosphere and storms. And I think one of the reasons they were so attractive to the, you know, the skies as a subject matter is because it remained out of the reach of science. It still had this kind of magical mystique. And that was really attractive to the kind of the artistic and imaginative type, you know. And I think it's true that the sky was the last part of nature to be classified. And you look at all the other things. I mean, rocks were classified by Werner in the 18th century, the great geological kind of experiments. Then you had things like gases, which were classified, things like oxygen and nitrogen and hydrogen were isolated in the 1760s. Before that, you had people understanding the human body, and Linnaeus with plants. So you've kind of gone through this period of maybe 150 years since Galileo and Newton and the scientific revolution, where people have been making sense of things and putting things into order. And yet the skies just were beyond, everyone thought they were beyond science. They were too chaotic. Mm. And there was no pattern that anyone could really make out of them. And I think that's an interesting starting place again, that, you know, it is the most elusive of all nature's components in a way. That was something that intrigued me too.
You begin the book right off the bat with, and I guess nobody really thinks about the weather until there's a storm. And there's this massive storm. I was surprised at the intensity of it. You talk about how 10,000 people may have died in this storm. This was in November of 1703. The Great Storm. It has a name now. Talk a little bit about that, because this is where you begin in a moment, and it's a way for you to sort of illustrate your point.
Yeah, I just wanted to sketch or just give people this this feeling of vulnerability that, you know, people just lived with before we had weather predictions or weather forecasts. And this was, as you say, the Great Storm we remember it as now, in 1703 in November. And it came, you know, pretty much at the time of year you'd expect a great storm to come in November. But, you know, people had no way of knowing how it was, you know, going to be so powerful. And so, you know, the people were out in the fields. People, you know, sailors were at sea, and they were all taken completely unawares, and it was the kind of storm which happens very, very rarely, maybe once every few hundred years, and it came with no warning, and destroyed much of London. I mean, Daniel Defoe, who was one of the great writers of the age, described it as being much more dangerous and destructive than the Great Fire of London, which we all talk about now, and people remember that much more than the Great Storm. And of course, it was doubly bad for all the sailors at sea, and they just were blown for hundreds of miles from England right across the Baltics, you know. And I think this is... I wanted to begin with that just to give people this sense of vulnerability, because in a way, weather was one of our most fundamental vulnerabilities as humans, and that's what people just lived with. That's an extreme example, but then you can go through and find many examples which happened year after year after year, when sailors would be drowned or houses would be blown down, and people would just be completely taken unawares. So the Great Storm is... it's the most dramatic example of that. There's lots of illustrations of the ships, and a lot of them were blown onto a sandbank just off, like, kind of Dover, which is in the south of England. And, it was a real shocking thing. And again, people had no scientific framework to put this within, so they had to kind of ascribe it to, to some punishment for some particular, like, kind of moment in the political cycle or in the religious cycle. And it so happened that there had been some religious problems over the last few years. And then, of course, it was ascribed. It's a bit like a crime. A crime has to have a motive. Well, a storm in those days used to have a motive as well, because it was all providential. So it would kind of send people into this great fit of introspection, if you like. So people would wonder, well, what have we done to deserve all of this? And so you can, of course, read all the pamphlets that were produced in the weeks and months afterwards. And there was a day of fasting 2 months later, I think, on the 19th of January. So that, you know, like, kind of people would, you know, kind of have to suffer a different punishment because they were so fearful of another storm coming. So it's it was a real, it's a real moment in our history, that, and it really kind of brings into relief this idea of being completely vulnerable to what nature's got in store for you.
I think one of the things that surprised me about the story is what an intense philosophical debate this was. Because, and I'm wondering why you figure that is. Was it the idea that somebody could, in essence... because you write about this toward the end of the book too, and we'll come back to this, but you talk about how that, like no other science, meteorology demands a kind of faith. And it's really in a part of the book where you explore how we're thinking about these things these days, at least in the context of, like, this intense debate over climate change. But how philosophical it was, this idea that you could predict the future seemed audacious and kind of unacceptable in some ways to some, because it seemed like they could grant science certain things, but you couldn't cross over these boundaries. And it seemed like in some ways predicting the future or predicting the weather was kind of one of those. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in Renaissance magic, aeromancy, which was divining the future using cloud formations and wind currents, this kind of stuff, was considered to be one of the seven forbidden arts. It was a dangerous, and it was something that people ascribed to witches and people with supernatural powers, and therefore you would and then you're straying into a very dangerous ground. And there was there was a famous, there was a story I came across of a man called Dr. D, who was living in the 17th century, and he had, been said to, he was so good at observing the atmosphere, he'd come to, the point where he could predict what the weather was going to be, or he had such skill in predicting the weather that he was, accounted a witch by everyone in his village, because that was the only way they could put this into any context. And I suppose what is it about weather which has this this philosophical edge is a good question, but I think it goes right back to the earliest writings. There's great accounts of storms and weather in the Bible, for example. You can go back and read them, and in a way, it is anyone who's been out in a storm or has seen, the atmosphere when it's at its most violent will kind of think it's one of the most majestic sights in all nature, really, in a way. And I think this is why we ascribe it to, like, kind of higher powers often. Mm. And when there was no scientific understanding at all, it was all the easier to do, really, I think. And that's something that you still get today. You'll see, like, when people's house is blown down by a tornado or something like that, then, you know, like, why did it go that way? Why did it twist on that course, mm-hmm. for example? And there's no, you know, it seems so chaotic that, in a sense, because, like, as humans, we're kind of inbuilt with this, like, kind of desire to make sense of things. And when you can't make sense of anything, you just have to kind of say, well, you know, like, there's a there's something greater at work, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what was going on very much then. I'll give you, like, kind of one of the great examples of a storm being used as a propaganda tool came in, I think it was 1588, when we had what we like talk about as a Spanish Armada, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with that story, but it's a real big moment in English history when the Catholic Spanish they decided to invade Protestant England because of some a little disagreement we had over the royal family, which I won't go into in any detail. But anyway, the Catholic Spain assembled this enormous fleet of ships, the Spanish Armada, and they sailed it up into the English Channel, at which point everything went wrong for the Spanish. There was, you know, kind of confusion. There was bad captaincy. But more than anything, there was, like, a really big storm, which, as they tried to escape, scuttled most of the ships, and lots of them were lost as they tried to escape round the top of Scotland and Ireland. And afterwards, there was loads of coins struck by the government at the time, or the Queen at the time, Queen Elizabeth I, sorry, and her council, which talked about the Protestant winds. These were seen as providential, the Protestant winds which had come to Britain's, or sorry, to England's aid at this moment of crisis, and protected, you know, Britannia from the Catholic Spain. So that was like kind of one example, but, you know, lots of little examples too.
Well, there are a lot of characters to talk about in this story. And I'm sort of trying to figure out which is the best way to start. Let's start with Robert Fitzroy. I know you talk a lot about him. He's sort of the, I guess in some ways he's kind of the main character, but there are others I do really want to get to. But let's start with him. For a lot of people, and if you mention that he was the captain of the Beagle, this was Charles Darwin's surveying vehicle, you think, oh, that's really cool. But it's interesting you talk about how, mm-hmm. in some ways, his association with Darwin in that particular expedition kind of is obscured what you see as his real contribution, which was the role that he plays in the science of weather.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's kind of two parts of Fitzroy's life. Later on, he sets up the Met Office, which becomes our great meteorological bureau, weather bureau, if you like, in Britain. And then before that, and during that time as well, he sets up the first weather forecasts and coins the word forecast, and we can maybe talk about that a bit later on.
Yeah.
Earlier on in his life, he was a dashing and very, I suppose, auspicious naval officer. He was born into the British aristocracy in 1805, so the year of the great victory at Trafalgar over the Spanish and French combined fleets. And he grew up in this kind of fervour of patriotism. And even though he came from a family where his grandfather had been a prime minister, his father was a duke, and he could trace his ancestry right back to, you know, kings before him. He decided not to go into politics immediately. He wanted to go to sea. And with his pedigree, if you like, and with his intelligence and his skill, he was soon elevated to become a captain of one of His Majesty's ships. But, of course, the problem for Fitzroy by this point is that it was a problem for the whole British Navy, I suppose, in a way, was that the wars had finished and they had all these ships and they didn't quite know what to do with them. And so they sent them all off on surveying, like, kind of jobs. And Fitzroy joined the Beagle during its first voyage, which is less known about, I suppose, around Tierra del Fuego and Patagonia in South America. And there Fitzroy really, I suppose, encountered weather in its most extreme form. You have things like Cyclones, which are hurricane squalls, so wind which gathers pace off the Argentine pampas and kind of roars out over Rio de la Plata. You know, I talk about them in the book as the kind of meteorological equivalents of a piranha attack, you know, just like really short and sharp and vicious. And then equally there'd be things like willywars, which is a wonderful word we don't use anymore. Again, similar things, but this would be when wind would be tunneled down over the Strait of Magellan by the, you know, the kind of the steep mountains which surrounded it. So it would kind of charge down there and gather at the bottom, and again a great squall which would be very sudden and very violent. And these were the kind of things that Fitzroy had to be wary of as a captain of the Beagle, which was only 90 foot long. It was a tiny wooden world. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, like kind of as a captain of a ship, you know, you had complete power over everything, and you might be making 200 orders a day, when to catch the wind, when to, you know, when to shorten sail, whatnot. And I think any wrong order can result in sailors losing their life. And this is what happened to Fitzroy on his very first cruise as commander of the Beagle. He didn't spot one of these pamperos, and he, you know, like kind of sailed straight into it, and two of his crew were blown off the rigging and were never seen again, drowned, you know, like kind of in minutes. And so I think for Fitzroy, like kind of he had this great respect for weather, which was kindled during his time in South America. And he also had, I think, a great humanitarian urge, because he saw, you know, like kind of how deadly it could be. And I think there was a curiosity there as well, because it was a time of scientific progress, and mm-hmm. and it was an area that was, as we've said before, it wasn't very explored, so he plunged into that, really. So that's the young Fitzroy. I should just add very quickly, he was, as a character, he was completely split. Darwin, when he did meet him a few years after the Beagle's first voyage onto the second one, which people know much more about, Fitzroy was described as Darwin, as a man who, you know, he said, "I've never before come across a man who I could fancy being a Napoleon or a Nelson," right. By which he meant someone who was so, you know, so good and so bad at the same time.
Right.
Because he was split, you know. He could be a humanitarian, he could be inspiring, but equally he had this savage temper which could flare unexpectedly, and he was subject to black depressions. So
what did he call them? Not the blue dogs. I can't remember the word he used.
Oh yeah, then yeah, they did. I mean, there's
that was Beaufort. I can't remember. He also suffered from black.
Well, the blue devils.
Blue
yeah.
devils.
There's
yeah,
a few
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
The few people in this book who were like kind of subject to depression, and yeah. they didn't have any of our modern terminology, I suppose. And if Fitzroy had been put into rehab in California in the 21st century, they'd have called him a manic depressive, I imagine.
Yeah.
But they hadn't invented that then. So
you know, the other thing that's interesting about Fitzroy, it seems like he has this other split, at least that I saw it this way, between science and religion. Because on one hand, he invents, as you say, the word forecast, because he wants a word that is separate. He wants a word that includes science and observation. So he comes up with this word. So he's devoted on that hand to science. But on the other hand, he's a really good friend of Charles Darwin, and they have a falling out because of Darwin's observations about the past. And Darwin becomes an atheist. And Fitzroy, he's a believer. He's an Old Testament kind of believer, and that seems like a split in his life too.
Completely, yeah. I mean, he was riven by this contradiction in his character, because he was so committed to the science, but he also was a complete, I suppose he was like a creationist, you'd say. He absolutely believed in the Book of Genesis as fact, and so you can imagine the split he had with Darwin. He was, and I mean, when Darwin published, you know, On the Origin of Species, like kind of Fitzroy, in a way, saw himself as being an accessory to a murder, because he was the person who'd taken Darwin on this voyage around the world, allowing him to like kind of collect all of these specimens, which had allowed him then to create this theory, which he had absolute contempt for. And he wrote into the newspapers complaining about it, saying it's not a logical arrangement of facts. I mean, Fitzroy I mean, and so Darwin, and obviously after this, Darwin and he have this falling out, which is never reconciled, really. And Darwin, you know, kind of writes quite a lot about this. He says that, you know, Fitzroy, for example, believed that the dinosaurs had become extinct because they couldn't walk up the gangplank to the Ark. You know, he was saying they were too big to fit through the door, and so to that, for Darwin, who'd kind of formulated his theories on evolution, he thought that was hilarious. Yeah. But Fitzroy, you know, kind of was ardent in this belief, and he would not shift. And so that does make it very strange then that he's so progressive in his meteorological work when he's so conservative.
You know,
in his
worldview. Sorry, I don't mean to cut in there, but it made me think about his epitaph. You include his epitaph on his grave, which is a beautiful bit from Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, and it made so I want to read it because it made me think about how he might be able to make that connection between science and religion. So here's the reading. It's "The wind goeth towards the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits." So there you have, you know, Ecclesiastes is really beautiful anyway, but this is, here you have something where there's this scripture that talks about there being some sort of process, a circuit. It goes here and it goes there and it returns again. It has a process, and maybe that's how he thought of it. You know what I mean? That's about that.
Well, I mean, that's a really nice interpretation of it. I think in a way, you do have a point there, because I think what Fitzroy was trying to do is trying to unlock this kind of great godly design of life. And I think he always maintained that the weather was a problem that could be solved. It was a puzzle that could be completed, albeit it was a very, very difficult puzzle. he admitted that much. But, you know, there was this idea that, you know, you had the Bible. I mean, this is a very Enlightenment idea. So you had the Bible as the first book of God. The second book of God was nature, of course. So just as you could get your moment of enlightenment from studying the Bible, from studying nature and actually seeing things that people hadn't seen before and understanding things that people hadn't seen before, that was actually a very religious, you know, like kind of meditative thing to do. And so I suppose you could therefore say that for Fitzroy, being a weatherman, or the first weatherman, which is in kind of what he was a ministry of sorts, because he was trying to unlock this godly puzzle and kind of explain it to people, so you know, for humanitarian benefit. So there is some really interesting contradictions there, but
Before we head to a break, I want to complete the arc sort of story of Fitzroy. He becomes a celebrity. I mean, he has these famous forecasts that he issues out. They even contain his name, and he collects all this information. It's a really complicated process, but he goes through it all, and he issues these forecasts, and he becomes loved when he gets it right, hated when he doesn't. But it's interesting. He comes to this really tragic end because he's kind of abandoned, or certainly forgotten. Do you want to say something about, without giving maybe too much away, but it's a really sad end to his life?
Well, no, I mean, he commits suicide in April of 1865, a very depressed man of 59, on the verge of his 60th birthday, which then was seen as, you know, the kind of great onset of old age. And he was weakened physically, and he'd worn himself out with his work at the meteorological office, because he'd been delivering these forecasts, the first of which came in 1861. And in the 4 years since, he'd just worked himself to the bone, basically, to provide accurate weather forecasts. And, you know, this was a completely, you know, ambitious, overly ambitious thing to do, because he had a threadbare network of maybe 20 stations that were sending him very small amounts of data. And he was trying to catch every storm as it went by. And when he didn't, he was mortified. And there would always be some human, you know, cost. And there might be some fishermen lost or something. And, when these forecasts worked, people loved them. And they were always called Admiral Fitzroy's weather forecasts. When they didn't work, he was derided, and people would write in and say, "Oh God, why are we spending money on Admiral Fitzroy's weather forecaster? So expensive, and he got this one wrong, and my wife's hat got ruined yesterday," and so on and so forth, you know. And so there was all of this, and you know, it kind of ranged from the very trivial to the kind of quite, you know, profound. And you know, like kind of the British weather or any weather doesn't, you know, it doesn't keep regular office hours. It doesn't work from 9 till 5 or something like that. It's all the time. So I think he did wear himself out. And but I think there was also a lot of his personality and his, you know, like kind of his character as well. He was a depressive and he struggled with that. And I think that's what kind of brought him down in the end. And it was very sad. He died very unappreciated. Very unappreciated indeed. And I think, in a way, like a parallel I've tried to make when I explained this to someone last week was with, do you know the Imitation Game film and Alan Turing? And,
sure.
And it's a similar kind of story in a way. Someone who's kind of got ahead of the science, or, you know, he's got ahead of society in a way. And it takes time for people to kind of catch up and say, oh, do you know what he was doing? He was actually onto something.
Yeah.
And that's really the, you know, the sad story. But it, you know, I think it's a positive story now, because he is very much appreciated nowadays.
Peter Moore is with us. His book is The Weather Experiment: The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. Joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer Peter Moore. We're talking about his book, The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. Moore writes about extraordinary, the early pioneers of this science, and they were artists and astronomers and adventurers who laid the foundations, he says, of meteorological science. He's joining us from the BBC in London. Well into the 18th century, you mention how it wasn't a very good way, really, until the telegraph, of transmitting messages. It was really slow. But the telegraph, the optical telegraph you write about, this becomes a really critical part in the development of meteorological science. But talk about this. I really liked this part of the book.
Well, the optical telegraph is, I think it's a wonderful bit of history, because it's, you know, when you talk about the telegraph, people always think of the electric telegraph immediately, and somehow kind of, you know, think past these optical telegraphs that existed before, which, you know, kind of came from the 1790s, invented in France by a clergyman called Claude Chappe. They kind of imagine them as like little diminutive windmills which are set on top of hills about, I don't know, 5 or 6 miles apart, or maybe 20 miles apart, depending on whatnot. And they would kind of make various shapes. So they, you know, kind of have arms that whirled around, and they would send very simple messages along a line. So if you imagine, like, kind of, I mean, the most primitive form of these would be the beacons that they used to have on hilltops, so, you know, to burn in an invasion, for example. But, like, this is like an evolution on these, because they had a vocabulary of their own, and they could kind of send news of things like war, or they could, you know, like kind of maybe even pass orders along the line and things like this. And they, you know, they were very much an invention of the revolutionary wars in France. And I mean, the development of them is quite interesting, but they caused, when the British found out that the French had invented this machine, they had a real panic, because, of course, everyone had been really localized until then. You'd only been able, really, to pass information at the gallop of a horse at the best. And then they had all these telegraph demonstrations in London saying, look at this French machine. There was a great poem which said, if only you'll just promise you'll none of you laugh, I'll have to be explaining the French telegraph. A machine that's endowed with such wonderful power, it writes, reads, and sends news 50 miles in an hour. Imagine that, 50 miles in an hour.
Right.
So these are kind of like primitive computer things. And so the French And the British, you know, like kind of at war, and then the French immediately had these things. And then, so where I really start off this narrative here is with the this Irish effort to build their own optical telegraph in the early 1800s. And it kind of all goes a bit wrong because, any invention which relies on bright blue skies in Ireland is never going to have a, right. a long future because it's not the place for it. But maybe work quite well in Utah if you want to have a go. I don't know. Maybe you can
give it a shot.
But yeah. Give it a shot. Let me know how they go.
Okay.
But
it brings us to Francis Beaufort, though, right? I mean, because he's one. He and Richard Edgeworth is. These are two in particular that you write about. Let's start with Beaufort.
Yeah, two fabulous.
Yeah, they're both great. Start with Beaufort because fabulous, he is this, you say he belongs to this romantic age. He's enthralled by the sublime. He goes on this roving period of his life. He survives a shipwreck. He starts writing these weather diaries. And he has this amazing kind of gift for observing the weather.
He did. He had an amazing gift for observing everything. He was, yeah. I mean, he wrote in his lifetime. I mean, when I was starting off on this book, I was interested to find any of his letters. And so I, you know, started looking around and found out that Beaufort's letters have actually ended up in, I don't know why, but they've ended up in Los Angeles. And so I got in touch with the library there. And they said they've got 20,000 of his letters. So they're all preserved and you can go and have a look at them if you like. And they're wonderful. They're just so lyrical. And, amongst them is this mania he has for recording weather, which, if you know his background as a ship's captain, again, similar to Fitzroy, you know, like kind of he has this affinity with the winds, you know, and he's always trying to capture what's happening every day. And so he goes through this period of, you know, like kind of having tried to put the optical telegraph together, fails, ends up on a boat in the Thames, is quite depressed by it because it's a very rubbish boat, and he feels that he's been cheated out of his promotion. And it's like one of these stories when you have a great mind left idle, it starts to wander into exciting, like kind of alleyways. And so what he starts doing in his journal one day in January 1806 is to kind of formulate a scale whereby you can, you know, kind of define different speeds of wind, and not just that, like kind of different states of the atmosphere. And he says something like, from this day forth, I'm going to record the wind as according to this like scale or whatnot. And it's the Beaufort scale pretty much that still survives today. And we still hear about on weather reports. In that case, it went from 1 to 13. So it's been trimmed down to 1 to 12 nowadays. But it's, you know, it's just, you know, just a bit of inspiration of a moment, really. And it's a typical Beaufortian thing to do, to look at something and then to try and make it sensible, try and make it like kind of, scientific. Mm. And it's a wonderful, just like a little bit of shorthand, really. And it's survived. And I think he'd be pretty surprised that it's still going today. But anyway, 210 years on or whatever, we're still using it.
Well, like in the shipping report, shipping forecast, you still hear the Beaufort scale and
The Beaufort scale, it comes out. I mean, well, the odd thing when you know the biographies of these people is we also have Fitzroy's in the shipping forecast as well. So you'll have this code which talks like Fitzroy 5, Beaufort 2 or something like this, and it's all codified, of course. But it makes you think of these original characters who were behind it all.
And Beaufort comes in contact with another remarkable man in the story, Richard Lovell Edgeworth, who is, he's one of Ireland's most enlightened men. I guess he's Beaufort's brother-in-law. Anyway, the two families are really close. Tell this story, if you would, in the book. Edgeworth has the scheme of transmitting information across long distances, and it involves this horse race and a big bet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's nice to think that, you know, the origin of these great inventions. So I told you before how Claude Schaap had been, he's the one credited with inventing the optical telegraph. Well, this really annoyed Edgeworth because, of course, he thought that he'd invented it 30 years before. And he had, of course, because he was sat around with his friends and they were talking, I mean, again, Edgeworth, I should say, is a member of the elite. He was a man of money. He was, kind of the heir to a lordship in Ireland. And he was sat around with his friends in a coffee shop, in London, and they were talking about the next great horse race. And you know, these were a gambling group of people, good Georgians. They liked gambling their money. And one of them said something like he planned to get the soonest intelligence of the result of this great horse race from Newmarket, which is, you know, I don't know, maybe it's 100 miles away from London or something. And he kind of set this project in motion, which was like kind of a, you know, a relay of horses. So he was going to get information before anyone else of the result of this horse race, bet all of his money, make a load of money, and it was going to be a good day for him. This, you know, kind of imagine a big fat English lord of the 18th century. And so Edgeworth was at the other side of the table, and he said, well, I'm going to get the information faster, you see. So he didn't divulge immediately what he planned to do, but he was a man with an engineering mind, and he'd of course thought of this optical telegraph. So all he needed was like kind of something which was capable of giving signals which relayed the result of the horse race. And anyway, it ended up in a bet between these two friends, and eventually Edgeworth had to come clean and say that he wasn't planning to use horses at all in the end. But that was really the genesis of the idea for like kind of, you know, kind of passing intelligence along, and it all came from this horse race. And I was never actually able to discover what horse race it was, which really really annoyed me. I wanted to find it out, but anyway, and so I still don't know. I mean, I still don't know who won this horse race to today, even though they were trying to get the first telegraph to send news of it down in, I think that was in 1767.
Wow.
So, you know, it's one of those great stories behind the invention of something. And yeah. I suppose, in a way, this telegraph technology was the internet of the day, you know.
Yeah.
This was like kind of, so it's the origins of the World Wide Web, in a way, maybe.
So many great stories. James Glacier, this balloonist. Luke Howard, who starts to identify, you know, he looked at the clouds and started identifying the different types. And maybe we can get to some of that. Before we head to a break, though, let's talk about John Constable. I loved this part of the story. Most know the name. He's a great British artist. And he drew clouds. Painted clouds.
He did. He for any of you who visited London, you'll know there's like kind of just above London, we got a heath called Hampstead Heath, and this is where Constable used to live. And he was a landscape painter, but he was very much like Beaufort before him, you know, in that way. He was a great observer of things. He loved to get small details into his artwork. So whether it would be, you know, the particular breed of cow that he was trying to paint, or, you know, the particular dress of the man who was walking through a river or whatnot. And he did this right down to the clouds. And we've just been through a period that you mentioned briefly, which was whereby Luke Howard had first come out with a cloud classification system. Mm-hmm. Things like cirrus and cumulus and nimbus and stratus, the kind of the main, you know, again, still used today. Yeah. With the different modifications. And Constable was aware of this, and he was also aware of a different meteorologist called Thomas Forster. And what he really wanted to do was bring this new found scientific accuracy into his artwork. And he said he didn't see why paintings couldn't be like science when the paintings was but an experiment. I think he said something like that. And he wanted to accurately capture clouds and skies for the first time, because if you look back, to the great artists before him, a lot of them just painted idealized skies. I mean, he was told, Constable, when he was training at the Royal Academy, just to consider the sky as a white sheet drawn behind his characters, behind his scene. And so they just fill it up with a few fluffy clouds here and there. But that wasn't good for Constable. He wasn't good enough for him at all. He wanted to be accurate. He wanted to capture how the light hit the ground, how the clouds move across the sky. And so he went up to Hampstead Heath and he did these cloud sketches, and this was his way of practicing. And and he did hundreds of these, really, and I don't think he ever intended them to be displayed. I think they were just there to inform his big famous landscapes like the Hay Wain, which is the most famous of all. But But today they exist, and they're so accurate, in fact, that they've almost got a photographic quality to them. And there's been a meteorologist who's used them and put them together, tried to join them together with weather records from the time to date them to specific days. And it's a really interesting kind of fusion of art and science, I think. And Constable said something, this was one of his kind of mantras, and I loved it so much I had them put it on the back of the book, which is, we see nothing truly till we understand it. And I love that kind of, it's just a kind of very pithy piece of wisdom, but it kind of really gets to the heart of how people thought in the early 19th century. It wasn't just good enough to, as Beaufort had before with the sublime, just let things wash over you and feel excited when they're there. That wasn't good enough for Constable. He wanted to understand, and he spent, kind of hours in the outdoors watching the clouds. And so if you take, you can go and pick a real good meteorologist and get them to have a look at Constable's artwork. Mm. And they will find them to be, I think, pretty accurate. I know, like, from the work over here, they're considered to be the most accurate clouds in landscape art, pretty much. Wow. And it's wonderful to look back at them and just think of that kind of scientific quality the paintings have, as well as the artistic angle, too.
Peter Moore is with us. His book is The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. We'll get some final thoughts when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have with us Peter Moore today talking about his book, The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. He's joining us from the BBC in London. Let me ask you something you write toward the end of the book about this this storm in October of 2013. It was called St. Jude's Storm. And you mentioned sort of maybe you weren't in the thick of it, but you certainly went out in the moments before it really hit. And you talk about how you wanted to feel that moment for yourself, which you describe as this kind of mix of anticipation and suspense, which you say is kind of the power of weather. Would you describe what you were getting at there? Because it's that sense of anxiety and tension that weather brings.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's this moment before the storm, which is, something that we are familiar with from, maybe people talk about the calm before the storm a lot in literature, and I suppose we've become familiar with it. And I just wanted to, I suppose when you're writing a historical narrative all the time, you're relying on the thoughts and the ideas of others. And in my writing, I'd kind of like to just, pass the baton over to them to do the explanation, really. So once I got the book, I thought, well, it's only fair enough if I go out now and put myself into this position, which, of course, it's not, nothing too unusual, but I just wanted to try and do some kind of prose what this moment felt like, because this is, I suppose, the kind of the crucial part of the idea of prediction, which is, when things are most acute is when there's a storm on the way. How do you know? And in this particular instance, the BBC had been telling us there was a storm on the way for about 5 days, so it was all very well signposted and everyone was kind of braced this thing, but we knew what time it was going to arrive to the minute. And I just wanted to go and really take all this 19th century weather wisdom with me, all these reports and artifacts that I'd read, all the prognostications and the predictions and things like that, and just look around me and with their wisdom coupled together with the scientific wisdom of today, just kind of try and describe the moment. And it was odd, trying to distill this into a page of prose or something like this. But again, it takes us right back to the beginning when you were talking about the Great Storm of 1803. It's a very similar thing. We might be different people, different generations, but men, we've all stood here in these moments and trying to second guess what's going to happen with the atmosphere. And today we have technology to help us out, and we have forecasts to tell us when to be careful. And maybe because we have all of that science at our back nowadays, or, at our fingertips, maybe we've become a little bit divorced, or maybe a bit extracted away from the actual, you know, natural world in a little bit, because maybe we don't look in the same way because we don't have to. You know, there's no reason for us to watch the swallows kind of skimming around, or the cows lying down in the field, or whatever it, you know, whatever it is. And there's lots of these kind of old bits of rural weather wisdom. Yeah, I just wanted to describe that, and I thought it kind of rounded the story off quite neatly, I hope.
Yeah, it was great. Let me ask you this finally. One of the things you say in the book is that forging a coherent pact between the science, the politics, and the economics of, I guess it's of global warming, of climate change, this is going to be one of the challenges of our age. And this is so fascinating. The night that Admiral Fitzroy is preparing for his first ever storm warning, this is in February of 1861, there's a professor of natural philosophy in England, John Tyndale, who delivers this lecture where he lays out the theoretical foundation, really, for greenhouse gas, for global warming. Would you say something about that? Only about a minute left, but we say something about that, because that's an interesting way to talk about all of this.
Yeah, I think this is a story which is going on today, and I was fascinated by this kind of chronological closeness to Fitzroy, who was, you know, pioneering all this forecasting, and, you know, the kind of the foundation of the climate change debate that we have today, which is so polarized and it's so splintered. And in a way, a lot of the arguments that people have today are the same arguments that people had in the 1860s over forecasting. And I wanted to kind of try and make that parallel, because I think history is always at its best when it's got some contemporary relevance, when it makes you actually kind of, you know, take what you're reading about these people then who struggled with these things and just try and, like, kind of apply it to now, because history gives us that sense of perspective. And I think, actually, like, kind of there are some important lessons for us to learn from, you know, within the, well, things that will inform the climate change debate from this period of history when people understood the skies and started predicting for the very first time.
Peter Moore. His book is The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. Joined us from the BBC in London. Peter Moore, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.